Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Support Rabble. Go to rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca. You're listening to Rabble Radio for May 2016. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. Well, in Canada, we don't like to talk about racism. We have this idea that racism is something that happens south of the border, but not here. Fortunately, we're starting to realize that's not entirely true. And one of the reasons why we have a dawning awareness that we do have issues in Canada to face as well, it's because of the people who will talk about racism and are talking about it. Today on Rabble Radio, Black Lives Matter. We're going to look at some of the differences between the Canadian and American movements, and even a look at some of the differences between the movement in Toronto and Vancouver. Two Canadian cities and two very different ways of working to solve racism and oppression. Black Lives Matter on Rabble Radio. Black Lives Matter is an international movement which was sparked by the acquittal of George Zimmerman after his murder of Trayvon Martin, who was an African-American teen. That happened in Florida in 2013. And that tragic event was the spark that lit the fire that burns brightly as Black Lives Matter. Here in Canada, we don't have as many chapters as there are in the United States, but the ideas are just as relevant. Today, we'll hear about the two Black Lives Matter chapters in Canada in two different cities. Black Lives Matter in Toronto and in Vancouver have very different ways of exploring and challenging racism, fitting their own cultural context. First to Toronto. Desmond Cole has emerged as one of the strongest voices for the rights of Black people in Toronto in recent years. A noted journalist, his articles have appeared in various publications including The Walrus, Toronto Star, Vice, and Now. He's a radio host on News Talk 1010 in Toronto and until recently was co-host of Canada Land Commons. He's one of the go-to people when the media explores issues of Black racism in Toronto. Rabble Podcast Network reporter and associate producer Kavesh B. got the opportunity to talk to Desmond Cole at Ruckus, which is the annual conference in Toronto to empower youth to act on issues of racism and oppression. It was held on April 28th at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. Desmond reflects on the progress of Black Lives Matter in Toronto over the past 18 months.
I find this whole evolution of Black Lives Matter to be really exciting. It's exciting to me. It's something that resonates with me and that I think we've been really needing here in Toronto, in the GTA, and in Canada. Because we like to pretend here that we don't have issues of racism. Or we like to insult people who experience racism in Toronto, the GTA, and Canada by being like, your racism that you might maybe experience is not as bad as the racism in the United States where you don't have to live or do anything. It's like telling somebody that they're lucky that you only broke one of their legs instead of breaking both of them. And they should be grateful that they only have one broken leg. This is how we talk about people who experience racism. Like, they should be fortunate that it's not even worse than it is. I don't know why it's so easy, by the way, for people to imagine these worst forms of racism and why that occupies so much of their mind. Like, why don't you just listen to what people are telling you, right? But we don't do that here in Toronto. And Black Lives Matter has forced us to do that. When Black Lives Matter recently got a huge kind of victory where they got a meeting with Premier Kathleen Wynne, one of the things one of their organizers said is that we just kept fighting until people couldn't ignore us anymore. And it's that resolve of the organization and of its members, of its organizers, that I find so interesting and powerful. Black Lives Matter Toronto started about a year and a half ago. I was in Ferguson, Missouri. I was covering the incident where Mike Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed teenager, was killed by a police officer in his town. And of course, this was not the first or second or 50th or 100th episode in recent memory like this happening in the United States. But there was something about Mike Brown's situation that captured the whole world's attention. And I think it was that the small town where he was from, the people who saw it happen to him just refused to let it go. And so they fought for months and months and months and months and got the world's attention. They got my attention too. I went down there. And at the same time as I was down there and people were having all of these protests across the United States in support of Mike Brown, we had one here in Toronto too. And it was organized by Black Lives Matter Toronto, and that was basically their origin. And, you know, they didn't just talk about Mike Brown. They brought it back home, and they talked about people like Jermaine Carby, who had just at that time been killed by the Peel Regional Police in Brampton. And a lot of people don't even know Jermaine Carby's name, and this is the tragedy in this country, is that we know Mike Brown's name. We know Eric Garner's name. We might even know the name of people like Tamir Rice. We certainly know Trayvon Martin's name. But the men who have been killed at the hands of the police or vigilantes in this community, we often don't know their names. In fact, all the racists who talk about how we should really be talking about black-on-black crime rather than talking about police brutality, ask them to name one person who's been a victim of this crime that they say that they're so obsessed with. We have all kinds of ways of talking around the issues here. What Black Lives Matter Toronto has done is they have said, no, you're going to say the names of Jermaine Carby. You're going to say the name of Andrew Loku, a 45-year-old father of five who was shot and killed by the police last year. There were no charges to that officer. You're going to say the name of Michael Elagon and Kwasi Skeen-Peters and other people in our community who died this way. In Canada, in Toronto, in the GTA. And it's really, really also quite inspiring to see how Black Lives Matter puts people who experience different intersectional levels of oppression at the front of their movement. So not just about black people. It's about black trans people, women. It's about black queer women. It's about people who have a disability who are black. And it's about centering those people at the front of the movement and letting them talk and letting them lead and letting them advocate, because they so rarely, in other circumstances and other movements, get a chance to do that. And that also goes for the sex work community. You know, I think it's been quite revolutionary to see Black Lives Matter Toronto put black sex workers as a group of individuals within their movement who they're like, we value these individuals. These individuals are helping to support this movement, and we support them in what they do, too. This is revolutionary stuff. So it's been a movement that has won political battles. It's been a movement that's gotten an SIU review requested by Toronto City Council, and that was a unanimous request. And the Special Investigations Unit is called whenever someone dies in the presence of the police, whenever somebody is seriously hurt in the presence of the police, or whenever a police officer is accused of sexual assault or sexual misconduct. And so the SIU investigates and then decides whether or not charges will be brought against police officers. And well, about 97% of the time, and I'm not making that figure up, the figure is 97%. 97% of the time that the SIU investigates a police officer in Ontario, which is their jurisdiction, they do not lay any charges. So we have a lot of concerns about how accountable is the SIU, and people should know that it is made up of former police officers. So it's former police officers investigating current police officers. And so you can begin to see why, when you have that and you have a 97% clearance rate, people are asking a lot of questions about how this organization is doing its job and if it's doing it properly, especially when its reports are secret. Mm-hmm. It is very rare that city council would vote unanimously on a proposal that has the words anti-black racism in it. Because going back to what I was saying, this is like our special move in Canada. We don't acknowledge that anti-black racism is a thing. You just don't talk about it. The way we try to deal with it is we don't talk about it. So for Black Lives Matter Toronto to say, we don't just want you to review the SIU, we want you to acknowledge that anti-black racism may be having an impact on the way that the SIU investigates the killings and hurt caused to black people. That's revolutionary. That's a big, big, big deal. And I think that they are a group to watch for because they insist on using language like this. This is I'm talking about anti-black racism, systemic racism, transphobia, intersectionality. These are not kinds of language that a lot of people are used to using, but the organization and the larger worldwide Black Lives Matter movement is making people have to understand these terms and to start thinking about them and to start considering them. And I think that that's really good. It's a movement that's gotten meetings now publicly scheduled with Kathleen Wynne and John Tory whenever they get around to it. It's a movement that secured a coroner's inquest into Andrew Locu's death so we could get more information into how he died. It's a movement which just last night helped to secure the SIU report that cleared officers who killed Andrew Locu released to the public. And as far as we know, an SIU report, which is supposed to educate the public, has never been released before now. And it's going to be in Andrew Locu's case, and that's because of Black Lives Matter. So I see a lot of people saying, oh, you know, they're doing a lot of shouting, they're doing a lot of chanting and protesting, when are they going to get to the real stuff? Those folks really just aren't paying attention. This is a political movement that's working on the inside as well as the outside to make change.
Mm-hmm. Just before we wrap up, I was hoping to get your insight into why this movement is so invigorating and inspiring for specifically to youth. You mentioned there was a survey whether folks in Toronto did think that systemic racism was an issue, and largely, although it was 55% of respondents did indicate that they did think it was an issue, a lot of that was concentrated in youth, in the youth response to that.
Yeah, the younger you are in Toronto, if you believe this survey, the younger you are, the more likely you are to acknowledge that systemic racism is a problem in Toronto and in Canada. Black Lives Matter is a youth-led movement. People who went to the historic protest that happened in front of 40 College Street, the police headquarters, would have seen that this was a movement of a lot of young people, a lot of students, a lot of really new people to the world of activism and public organizing. And I think that that's because Black Lives Matter Toronto cuts through the crap, quite frankly. I think that, you know, we see all of these backlashes online where people want to talk about nonsense like reverse racism, where people want to talk about all lives matter. I mean, like, I can't think of a more, like, lazy and privileged response to Black Lives Matter than to say, did you come up with that yourself? All lives matter? Oh, that's really good. That's like a fireman going to a neighborhood where all of the houses are cool, but one of them is on fire. And the fireman just decides that he's going to put his water on every single house because all houses matter after all, don't they? This is the crap that we have to put up with just for trying to speak about our issues as black people. So people want someone to cut through the crap. And that's what this movement is doing. And young people especially who have to hear these messages, who have to contend with these messages, who know, even though we live in what people want to call a post-racial society, they know that there's still discrimination. They especially are really connected to what Black Lives Matter is doing. But I'll tell you something. Again, for those who went to that protest, that was an intergenerational gathering. And I don't know very many of the elders in the Black community in Toronto who didn't also show up to that. So folks who were fighting for things like the Black Action Defense Committee 20 and 30 years ago, who also fought these issues of police brutality, they went. They donated. They supported Black Lives Matter. A lot of them said to me, you know, our time to fight is over. This is now for the young people. But they also were there in support. And it's quite an exciting moment to see just how united many different groups of Black people are in Toronto right now. It's a very exciting time.
That was activist and journalist Desmond Cole talking to Rabble associate producer Kavesh B. Thanks to Kavesh for doing this interview for us. And it'll also be featured on a brand new show that Kavesh is working on for Rabble. The new show, Rumble, will be on the radio. It'll be on the air at CJRU, the newly launched radio station at Ryerson. It's at 1280 AM in the heart of downtown Toronto. Now, the station's been on the internet since 2013, and they've just made the very exciting transition to the airwaves on March 31st of this year. So we're very, very happy that we're going to be joining the broadcast schedule. And we'll also be making the radio show available to campus and community radio stations across the country. And of course, we'll be uploading it to the Rabble Podcast Network, so you have lots of ways to hear our brand new radio show. We'll keep you posted about our launch date. You're listening to Rabble Radio for May 2016. Black Lives Matter. Two cities, two approaches. And we're going to move west right now to hear about Black Lives Matter, the Vancouver chapter. This coming interview is done by Charlene Sayo from her excellent podcast, Ms. Represent. Charlene took a hiatus to gather more material for a few months this year, and we're really, really glad that she's back. So here's some context. In a city known internationally as a gateway to Asia, many Vancouverites are asking if Black Lives Matter, whether a chapter on the West Coast is necessary. Our next interview is with Cicely Bell Blaine. She's an artist, organizer, and founder of Black Lives Matter Vancouver. And she says that yes, it is necessary to have this chapter. And she's not alone. Last month at the chapter's first public event, a political mobilization on the steps of the Vancouver Art Gallery drew over 500 dedicated activists and supporters. Here's an excerpt from Ms. Represent's far-ranging discussion about Black history in Canada and the Black Lives Matter movement in Vancouver with host Charlene Sayo.
When we think of slavery in Canada, why is it that most Canadians will automatically think of the American South,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
but not even think that there was a very long history of slavery?
Yeah. I think Canada has done an excellent job of erasing that history from the history books and from things that we learn about Canada. Canada has such a sort of global reputation of being such a peaceful country, and that's led to, you know, pushing a lot of things under the rug, particularly in relation to colonialism and like things like sterilization, segregation, slavery, particularly of Indigenous people and Black communities as well. And so particularly I think like a lot of what I've studied at university, I was doing European studies, and so we studied a lot about like World War II and how that was a really big time for nation building, and Canada was really building itself as like the peaceful nation, always, you know, giving foreign aid, and then that was, you know, Canada is so peaceful and great now. Mm-hmm. And so I think people really buy into that image of Canada, and it's so easy to then completely erase those histories.
Yeah.
I think you can definitely say that slavery happened on a smaller scale here, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen here at all. And I think because of the, you know, the end of the Underground Railroad being in Canada and a lot of freed slaves coming to Canada after the quote-unquote end of slavery, yeah, you can see how people might feel like Canada was a safe haven for a lot of people after that time, but really there was also a lot of terrible things happening here. Like, thinking specifically about the history of BC and the Lower Mainland, a lot of freed slaves who came from California came here and then also experienced pretty much the same racism and negative attitudes and discrimination towards them that they were facing back in the US. So it wasn't much of a escape or a freedom to come here. Historically, there was a very big Black population in Vancouver, but that population was pretty much wiped out, especially after the building of the Georgia Viaduct.
And you've heard this, mm-hmm. is that whenever I have friends from the East Coast coming here, they will notice the very large and very high population of Asian Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
But the one question they always ask is, where are all the Black people?
Yep. Yeah, as I mentioned, a lot of the communities sort of being wiped out when Black communities first started coming to Vancouver. There was a lot of hostility. It was difficult for them to like buy land. And like, I think that's one of the huge things that enabled people to stay in a community is the ability to buy the land, which ironically is not Canadians' land to sell, belongs to the Indigenous people. But like, that was a huge like kind of issue of discrimination. So there was no ability to like settle and make roots here.
Yeah.
And I think that was also evident, for example, Salt Spring Island was completely a Black community.
Really?
Yeah. So lots of freed slaves came and like set up communities there. I was actually looking at some photos online. They're so interesting. And it showed like a classroom of students on Salt Spring Island. And one man was the first Black teacher on the island. And like his kids in his class, like Black students, white students, Indigenous students, Asian Canadians. It was a really amazing photo to think it was taken in the 1920s and to see such a diverse classroom of students like back then. It's so fascinating. But yeah, that history has been completely erased as well. And now we sort of just think of Salt Spring as sort of like a white hippie island, in my opinion. So
yeah,
it's so interesting how those like histories of like white communities having a lot more privilege and therefore being able to settle and make roots because there was less discrimination against them for purchasing land. And yeah, so thinking about present day and like Black communities in Vancouver, I think we talked about it a lot at our event. We had a speaker, Angela Marie McDougall. She's the director of the Battered Women Support Service. And she was saying there is no universal experience of being Black, especially in a place like Vancouver. We have like, even among like our organizing collective, for example, like people who are born and raised in Vancouver, people who are born and raised in African countries or Caribbean countries, people like me, who I also was raised in the diaspora in England, but not in Canada. So like such a diverse range of like knowing what it means to be Black. And I think it's really hard to unify communities that are so like different and are so, other diasporic communities have a much easier time kind of connecting and collaborating because, you know, they miss home or they have an ideal of their home country, whereas we're all from such diverse places. And I think that is also thanks to like different migration patterns and like histories of slavery and colonialism that like not everybody knows where their roots are and not everybody knows where they come from. And so, yeah, uniting a Black community is really, really hard.
But what I have noticed in the last probably 2 years is that, at least in Vancouver, that there is a larger presence now of, mm-hmm. of Black Canadians. There's more.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the United States? Are there more people leaving the United States because of what's going on, mm-hmm. Since, you know, what happened in Ferguson and Baltimore? I mean, is it wrong to say that maybe there's more of an influx from the United States coming into Canada?
I don't know. I think that could totally be possible. I mean, I've seen a lot of like articles online about African Americans really expressing concern about the experience of being Black in the United States. Like, it is, you could say, dangerous, like to live and exist as a Black person in the United States. And I think, yeah, as I mentioned before, the kind of peaceful image of Canada kind of perhaps allows people to think that it might be safer to live here as a Black person. But I also think a lot of the Black folks that I do know in Vancouver, a lot of them are international students from different African countries and the Caribbean as well. Like definitely a lot more Black students at UBC since I started there in 2012. Definitely I've, as you mentioned, like I've seen a lot more people around and always like, oh my gosh, new Black person, so exciting. So, but yeah, I think the development of like, there's a new scholarship that specifically brings students from sub-Saharan Africa, and that's brought a lot of people from sub-Saharan African countries, so that's pretty exciting. But yeah, as I said, it also leads to a kind of like, how do we find that unity with all the different Black communities? Like, I think there's a pretty exciting Black community over at UBC and SFU as well, but that I think it's also a very cultural community, particularly relating to African cultures and like gathering around celebrating those cultures. But of course, if you were born and raised here and if your parents were also born and raised here, you might not have that connection to say your African heritage, for example. So yeah, that can be a little bit alienating for some folks. Yeah.
But yeah, how do you see the connections with Toronto and Vancouver? And I'm using Toronto as the example for sure. Because there's a chapter there in Toronto, and then there's also a very large Black presence in that city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were sort of thinking about, like, how do we really, like, honor and respect the Black community that we have in Vancouver? Because the needs are very different. Thankfully, we're not necessarily directly tackling police brutality, for example, because there hasn't been that much instances that particularly specifically affect Black communities. Whereas in Toronto, in Ferguson, in other cities, there's definitely been that. And we definitely want to honor the origins of the Black Lives Matter movement and stand in solidarity with other cities who do experience that. But we also want to kind of be a support system and a network for Black folks here. And we don't want to alienate them by only focusing on things that they feel like might not be happening in this city. So, yeah, that's always in the back of our minds. But we're trying to move more towards, like, what do people in Vancouver need and in the Lower Mainland, and yeah, how can we support Black communities here? So some of our ideas were around, like, supporting African refugees. A lot of African refugees trying to seek refuge in BC, but there's actually been a block by the government put on refugees from any country other than Syria. Yeah, and also, like, trying to celebrate Blackness, trying to celebrate the history of Blackness and bring it back to the forefront of the imagination of Canada, because it's been pretty much erased. Also celebrating a lot of the elders in our communities as well. And we have a lot of good connections now. We've raised quite a bit of money. We have a good support system. So I'm hoping that we can sort of be there for the Black community in whatever way they need. And hopefully we will learn what that is. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. In terms of what's going on in the United States, the political climate there, there's this sentiment that many Americans desire to move to Canada. Some are very serious, some are joking. You know, what advice would you like to say or give, especially to African Americans who think that maybe Canada is a safe haven?
Well, I know that a lot of people sort of make a huge distinction between the experience that Canadians have and the experience that Americans have, but I think like comparing them is challenging. I wouldn't say one is necessarily better than the other, but I do think in the US it does seem more dangerous and more terrifying to be an African American because of the police brutality that a lot of folks experience. But I think for me, like, coming from Europe, I just, like, see the whole of North America as kind of like one big thing, and, like, I didn't really realize until I came here that people view the two countries so differently, that people think, you know, America is kind of, like, wild and dangerous and, like, Canada's so peaceful. I thought it was all just, you know, one big, like, continent of the same stuff. So, and I think that's also another way that I still see it, like, even though I've become more knowledgeable and educated about it, I still kind of look at it that way, because there's very few differences, you know, if we look at, like, how the government is structured and the lack of representation of, like, Black people and, like, Asian Canadian folks and queer folks and women. Like, that lack of representation is mirrored in both Canada and the US. And I think that has a huge impact on how the countries are run and how much support is given to marginalized communities.
That was Cicely Bell Blaine in conversation with Charlene Sayo of the Rabble podcast, Ms. Represent. You can hear the whole interview by going to msrepresent@rabble.ca/podcasts. And finally, before we sign off, I want to thank you for listening to this podcast and your support of rabble.ca in general. We want to bring you more podcasts, more videos, more stories, more perspectives, because with corporate media, you get the kind of news that they want you to hear. At Rabble, we work very hard to bring you a very different perspective. Now, we don't need to make the multi-millions that the corporate media barons seem to require, but good research, writing, and stories require good money. So if you haven't done it already, please give as much as you can so we can continue to do what we can and do more of it. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate to make your contribution. And if you can make a monthly contribution of $15, we can say thank you by giving you a copy of The Illegal, the latest book by Lawrence Hill, or Michael Moore's latest film, Where to Invade Next. And that's our show for this month, May 2016. Thanks to our contributors, Kavesh B. and Charlene Sayo. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next month.